Okay, my guest on Podcasting Softly is a very talented filmmaker, Barry Hunt. He's the director of the further adventures of Anson Buell in No Man's Land. Barry, thank you for being on Podcasting Softly. Great film.
Thank you for having me. So you were able to see it.
I was able to see it, yeah. I got to say, when watching it, I kind of got a bit of, and we can discuss your influences, but for me personally, I got a bit of a Herzogian, Jodorowsky, Jean-Jacques Annaud type feel when watching it. Were they some of your influences?
I think I'm from that culture, and not necessarily direct influence. So a lot of the influences for me were Fellini and Bergman,
Right.
and those pre-CGI kind of dreamy psychological filmmakers, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So, for those who are unaware, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to filmmaking, your influences, your journey towards making this film?
Yeah, that's great. I was an actor. I started as an actor and worked in a variety of genres, theater, film, television, et cetera, just a little bit.
Right.
And then later moved into directing, predominantly in the theater. My company is a theater company, an ensemble theater company in Portland, Oregon, and we've been together and producing for about 20 years.
Right.
And the story, Further Adventures of Anson Buell in No Man's Land, was a play that we produced in 1998 by Tanya Myron.
Right.
And so it was really rooted in the theater initially. But the journey into film is an interesting one because we have a training ground. We have a philosophy and an approach to training actors and directors and across generations. And so we had a lot of young people, 12, 13, 14, that went into film. And as we were mentoring them through their early film projects, and some of them have done quite well, sold at Sundance, things like that, we just realized, oh, we were in a position now and to consider film as a possibility. And then going back to Anson Buell, because it's so visual in its language,
Yes.
we were attracted to that to be our first film project.
It's very much a pure cinema piece. And oddly enough, when I started watching it as it went on, oddly enough, the film that came to mind was not so much the first half, but the second half of Beyond Thunderdome. With
Yeah, definitely.
the kids in the valley and all that sort of stuff. Was the
Right, there are definitely some parallels. I don't know that that's for Tanya any a source material, but there's definitely parallels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So talk us through a little bit of how like you said, it started as a theater piece. Can you tell us a little bit about the development of the script and then eventually the shooting?
Yeah, sure. So we were the language is very unique. Tanya created an original pidgin dialect. It uses or utilized, she was studying 12th century liturgical literature at the time.
Wow.
And so she was influenced by that kind of biblical language and had the idea. It all came from a word that she heard. She heard the word carkin, and it captured her imagination.
Right.
And then she heard the word clubbers in relationship to club kids.
Right.
And she kind of heard that word a little differently. And then Anson Buell started forming in her mind as characters. And so from the language, we were taken to how to attack it as a film, how to manifest the culture, the future world that she created, but to use that language as the base, as that dialect, and where would these people, these characters originate? Because in the play, they're already on the road. We see them already on their journey.
Right.
And so we were trying to backtrack to say, okay, what kind of objects do we need to create? What kind of rituals do we need to create? What kind of and so we wanted a source, and that's where we kind of came up with the idea that they would be from a Jesuit orphanage,
Right.
because the language is also peppered with a little bit of French, a little bit of Spanish, so it's predominantly English. And so we were like, where would there be a culture that would be this diverse, and yet this naive? either way.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's where we went, okay, if they're kids from a Jesuit orphanage, they're going to have that eclectic background. If they're separated from the adults, that's going to put them in a position to be working with memories that aren't clear. So a lot of the language, they don't even know what they're saying. It's repetition. We know the words maybe in some ways that they don't.
Yes.
And so there's the naivete in it is where we look to, let's start them out as children.
Another film, sort of, as I was watching it, that sprang to mind was Anod's Quest for Fire. Did you ever see that?
No, I don't know. I'm familiar with the title, but I haven't seen it.
Mm.
What about it was capturing you?
Well, I mean, not so much the... for me, it's never to do with the plot. It's more to do with the compositions and the overall cinematic nature of the story, because it's in that film, while it's about essentially Neanderthalic men searching for fire, you know, but the journey across these sort of barren landscapes, and because I mean that film, obviously they don't speak at all because they're cavemen. But the whole
you are reminding me that I have seen parts of it.
Yeah, and it's very, you know, that's what I liked about your film, is it's something that is not done very often, but when it is done, it's more subjective in a sense, like, you know, the Robert Redford movie where he's lost at sea on a boat and he's got to stop the boat from sinking. I forget the name of it. All Is Lost, I think it's called. It was done recently.
He did. Robert Redford did a movie called Jeremiah Johnson too, as well, where he had almost no dialogue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that it's great because it's a style of filmmaking that is, I won't say is lost, but, I mean, it's not something that's, you know, perpetuated a fair bit, you know, of late.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Yeah, and the influences that I mentioned, like Herzog, like Jodorowsky, like Arnold, they're very, that they're, I mean, while they made other films that are conventional in their structure, they did also make films like Quest for Fire, like Aguirre, like Holy Mountain, and as you mentioned, like Fellini. I'm a big fan of the movie Amarcord. Have you seen Amarcord, obviously?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
I've definitely seen a lot more Fellini. There's a little bit in here too of Warhol, is like horror movies.
Right.
A lot of the dreams, they have some of that type effect, or the dreams or visions or Buell's visions.
Yeah.
Have that type of influence as well.
But what I liked was that, you know, it definitely, like, when I mention these movies, obviously not the plot, but the very cinematic nature of the storytelling, like, it's purely visual, there's not a whole lot of dialogue. I also like the way that, you know, there's a suggestion of this apocalypse, but it's not, you know, it's a bit, like, it reminds me of another sort of thing that came to mind while watching it was Cormac McCarthy's The Road. More so the book than the film. Even though there is a suggestion in the film that there is a kind of explosion or something, but in the book, and certainly in parts of the film, we see the decimated landscape, and are not quite sure, you know, what is primarily the cause. Was it one nuclear explosion? Was it many? And obviously the place is cooling down. They're falling into a nuclear winter.
Right. Uh-huh.
But I like the fact that you don't. I mean, there's a hint of something happening, like just as the black and white opening finishes, you know, and the young lad with the baby under the table and all that type of thing. And
right.
I like the fact that it's not explored, because again, if it was a conventional film, you know, they would say, oh, you would have a sequence where you see what caused this whole thing,
right?
You know, but
there is that question the audience wants to know, because I mean, that opening was, we had several different openings, and we had a lot of screenings where we never addressed it, and had several different types of openings, but that was, the audience really had a desire to know, but we wanted to relieve them of the pressure with concerning themselves too much with it, you know, and just kind of accept it rather than question through the whole film. is this logical based on that being the initial source? So we didn't want to get caught in that question.
And another thing that came to mind, or something that that got me thinking a little bit, was Samuel Beckett ever an influence?
That would definitely be, especially from my theater background.
Yeah, because there's moments that are very, I found very sort of Waiting for Godot, and, you know, when Arndt and Buell are sort of alone talking, it's almost like, you know, we need to go, you know, it's almost like... well, for me anyway, that it kind of had a, you know, the, you know, two guys on the road, you know, and they're, and that, I don't know, because it's, one could say, because of the minimalist nature of it, that yes, it, you know, it's very reminiscent of Beckett in that sense, but, you know, something that is, for a film that isn't encumbered by a lot of, how should we say, filigree, it is astonishingly compelling, because when there's nothing else, it's like watching a one-man theatre piece. There's nothing to distract you, and it's up to the caliber of the actor per se to hold the, you know, to hold the audience's attention. In this case, I found both the acting to be strong, but the story is compelling, and you really find yourself wanting to stay with it.
Well, that's great. Yeah. There, not everybody does. You know, a lot of people pull out after a little while.
Yeah.
I'm happy to hear that.
Mm.
Part of the appeal for me is the simplicity of it. That there's something a little bit vast about it, and at the same time, it's really four characters. You know, ultimately, then three. And really focusing on their journey, their relationships, their transformation, their living in that circumstance. And it's the humanity of it that I appreciate in the simplicity.
And coming from directing theater, there's fewer and fewer directors working that have come from directing theater to directing film. I mean, a few names come to mind, like Francis Coppola directed theater before he directed films, Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
What was it like for you? Was it a fairly smooth transition as far as directing?
Interesting. Part of it is again, kind of, you know, I'm not a young man, so my generation, that 70s film, was very theatrical. I just saw Day of the Locusts. We saw Day of the Locusts. It's very theatrical.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of imagery in film before CGI that was coming from theater.
Yes.
And, you know, there was an element of that type of approach. Tarkovsky is one of my favorite filmmakers. And one of the things, Andrei Tarkovsky, one of the things I like about what he does with a dream sequence is he'll do it in one take. And so it's one long take that's panning across a series of actions and maybe transformations. So there'll be like a mirror, and then right on the other side of the mirror, you're dropping back. So he does it without cuts.
Yes.
And that was something I was really interested in exploring, was a kind of, in the visions, was something that was employing that a little bit old school theatricality.
Mm.
And I felt that was within my, my wheelhouse, you know what I mean, to approach film in that way.
Totally. Yeah, I was gonna ask you if Tarkovsky was, because I got a bit of that sense watching it as well.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites, especially philosophically.
Yes,
I really appreciate his thought about film and his belief that the film, that the camera sees everything, and that it has to live inside the shot, that it can't be manipulated in the editing as much. You know, whatever you actually captured on the screen is what that shot holds. You know?
Yeah.
He calls it sculpting in time.
I saw a great documentary about him some years ago, and I loved the... It's something I hadn't noticed, because I've seen all of his films, but the filmmaker or the documentarian pointed out that the fact that his first film begins with a young boy under a sapling, you know, and his last film ends with an old man under a tree or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
And I just thought, you know, what a, you know, perhaps subconscious bookending to, you know, the films that he made. But,
right. And that's really the big influence in Ensemble is the subconscious, you know, the subconscious. And that's where I really relate to Tarkovsky as well. Is, you know, we do a lot of collaborating, and, you know, with my cinematographer, we didn't have a shot list.
Yeah.
You know, we knew the images we were going with, and we would come in and I would show him what we had, you know, that day or the staging, and then he would kind of look at it through the lens, and I can see him, you know, a monitor of what he's actually exploring. And he was really fast for a while, and I kept saying, hey, think slower. Mm. And then I could follow what his thought process was, and then I could get on his page,
yeah,
you know, visually, and then we were really collaborating. And he made a comment on our last day of shooting, and he said, nobody would ever make a film this way, but all of the best parts are because we
did. Yeah.
And I think it's that trusting the intuition and the subconscious.
Yeah.
To be at play while you're, you know, particularly for this story.
Totally. And how long was the production? Was it a long time, short?
It took a while. We shot over 2 years. A lot of that was practical limitations. We, those opening landscapes, you know, not the very, very opening, but the, you know, when they're out on the road, that's in a gorge near a river between Oregon State and Washington State,
sure,
where I live. And we were at the, for us, summer into fall, so we're at the end of August going into September, and the light was amazing, and we didn't quite finish. And so to come back to that, we had to wait a year.
Right.
So we had to come back a year later, and luckily, you know, because we're ensemble performers, you know, we all work together anyway.
Mm.
So we came back a year later, just had to, you know, make sure that the weight was about the same and the hairstyle was about the same and pick it up. So,
right.
Yeah, it took 2 years to shoot, a year in post, and probably a year or more in pre-production.
Right.
So, yeah, it was a long process.
Yeah. I mean, that's why they say you have to, when you set on telling a story, even simply writing a story, you better love it, because you're gonna invest a couple of years into your life doing it. So,
yeah, and if you think of it, we produced this twice now. So we did it in 1998 as a play, and then again 20 years later. So yeah, we love the story. We don't get tired of it.
Yeah. You know? And how did it go when it was a theater piece?
It was very well received. You know, locally we won like 4 awards, won best production and design, and won one of the acting awards.
Right.
And yeah, it was did well then. It won best cinematography in Santa Fe,
right,
in 2003 for the film.
So the reception all around for the film has been good?
It's good, but it had trouble finding a wide audience, and so we feel like right now we're being discovered. This film is being discovered right now, and it's been out for a little while.
Yeah.
And so that's really pleasing, because we were uncertain of the kind of the how to get to the audience. I think it has a varied audience,
yeah,
but really kind of being found by the post-apocalyptic film community, that really opened the door. And I've been doing quite a few interviews lately, and we've gotten about 4 or 5 really good reviews.
Mm.
And that's all brand new, you know, that's all happened in the last month.
It's interesting when you change, you know, your tact and come at the marketing of it a different way. Certainly when I was, you know, made aware, it was sold to me as post-apocalyptic, and I've interviewed a few independent filmmakers now that's the genre of their inaugural film. And it's a genre that has so many, I mean, there's many different ways you can approach it. There's obviously the, you know, the Mad Maxian dystopian Waterworld-y type deal where the remnants of the past are retrofit to, you know, what, you know, existing technology, and people are surviving in the harsh environment. But then you have the quiet sort of, like, I interviewed this very talented gentleman, not unlike yourself, Andrew Barker. He's made a film called The Reckoning. And it's basically, you know, one guy left in this particular area and everything's been wiped out, and he's like a sole survivor, sort of kind of like the last man on earth type story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the Vincent Price film, which would later be remade as The Omega Man.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a genre that can go either way. It can be big, you know, big sort of spectacle like The Postman, you know, for example, which is, you know, considered a post-apocalyptic story. Or like this film, like Anson and Buell, you have this, you know, in some arenas poetic, melancholic perhaps. But, you know, but always intriguing how people view the world after a disaster, don't you think? You know, it's often... Yeah, I was saying it's often intriguing how, you know, the life after a disaster is interpreted. You know, it's very much... It's either like, you know, there's still a lot left behind, like people living in the remnants of the old world or the decimated world. Or it's, you know, it's the opposite. Enough time has gone by that a society has, you know, re-emerged, essentially building on the ashes, you know. But, you know, I mean, what I liked about this film, though, you know, aside from picking up the influences, was the, you know, it ultimately... because the landscape is decimated, these films become more about people, more about characters than the world that they inhabit. I mean, I think some of the big post-apocalyptic blockbusters and all that sort of thing are more about the world than the people, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And more about...
Yeah, we had a lot...
Yeah, no, go on.
I was going to say, we had a lot of fun with the design. Like you said, it's some of the bigger films, it's much more about the world, that's the future world, the new world, or whatever, and so it becomes so much about the design, and we had a lot of fun with the design because it was essential, it was necessary, but it is, the resources were so limited, and so we had a lot of fun with the men because it was like, okay, so they only have so much, their resources are extremely limited, and they're falling away, and so it does stay focused on the humanity. But I think part of what's fun for me in the film is that they're so, in a sense, ill-equipped as well, because they, one person who was more familiar with the genre, like, immediately looked at him and said, hey, they have no armor. Oh, the land's grown, you know, it's coming back. The land's coming back. Oh, they, you know, it's all soft. And the naivete of the culture of the men is really interesting because it's actually very violent. And at the same time, they're not warriors, in a sense, and they don't have armor, and they're not very good at it, and they're out on the road so long this time that they're not going to be able to find their way back, and every decision they've made has left them with less and less and less and less and less, to where by the end, Buell doesn't even have a robe anymore, and they're not going to find their way back, and so it's a really interesting notion that they kind of lose everything along the way to be able to head off into the future, you know. And yet at the same, and they do lose everything because the only thing they did have in place of that armor was beliefs.
Yes.
You know, they believed so strongly in the culture they created and in the boogeyman and, you know, the people they needed to kill. But by the end, those are gone too. And so I love how empty they are at the end and how their resources are just gone. By the end, including their beliefs, and yet they're kind of freed from something.
I mean, I don't know whether or not part of your influence, but it almost has kind of a biblical connotation. You know, you're like Moses, you know, leaving Egypt and passing through the desert, and he had to, you know, be shed of, you know, as it's told in the Ten Commandments. You know, he had to be stripped of everything. The metal had to be, you know, softened.
You know, I didn't write it, so I go back to Tanya again, and so she definitely was influenced, like I said, by that liturgical literature and the mythology, and so it's definitely influenced, and I think that's probably what took us to, hey, this language is rooted in the midway in the church, that's rooted in the characters in the church, but at the same time, it's not really a religious film, it's not...
No.
You know, it's not dogmatic in any way.
No.
We shot some scenes in a Catholic church, and they were a little concerned. They said, is this going to, you know, cast a negative light? And I said, no, it's not going to change anybody's mind about the church one way or the other.
No.
It just happened to be that that's where these people came from.
No, I mean, I wasn't insinuating that. I just thought it had that sort of like the, you know, almost like there's a Ewan McGregor film recently of Jesus, you know, wandering in the, you know, when he wandered the desert and all that sort of thing, and he had to be tested. I sort of meant it in that sense, that it's very much a journey where they are, like you said, shedding the past, and it's really the only way that they can go on, because like any culture that's been decimated, of course, for the longest time, they cling to, you know, the shadows of the past, and because it, you know, for many reasons, probably a comfort factor, but you know, with a sort of metaphysical film like this, it you know, they shed, as you say, they in the film they lose it, but in a sense, you know, in a different sense, they're slowly shedding their past, so that they come to this new place sort of ready and open to what's going to be. I must admit, when I was told the title first, I was thrown a little bit. I'm not saying I thought it was going to be a comedy or something, but sort of the further adventures of Anson Buell, you know, I mean, it kind of has a different, I don't know what I thought. I thought, you know, the further adventures, you know, when there was always something with his adventures in it, like the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Right. Exactly. You know,
it had this.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that's Tanya's, maybe personal joke to her.
All right.
I think to her, it's the title is probably amusing.
Yeah. Yeah,
we've thought before about changing it and just calling it Anson Buell and stuff like that, but we went back to it once, right at the end, we were like, nope, that's the title, let's keep it. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, but just when I read the start of it, I was thinking, oh, maybe it's a post-apocalyptic comedy. But I mean, even then, for something that is sparse and laconic and it has a very much a Beckett quality, I mean, the title, when you think about it, isn't really out of place. You know, even if it was something called No Man's Land or something like that, which would maybe come, if it was simply No Man's Land, someone might, you know, cry pretentious.
Right.
But you know, but it's in the end, when you really sit and think about it, because it is a film that you sit and think about after you watched it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of these biodegradable films that you forget about 5 minutes after or 2 minutes after you left the room or the theater. Mm-hmm. It does all sort of nicely fit together. It is fitting, because, you know, I think something like, if it were simply called, say, per se, No Man's Land, you know, I think that would give something away early on, but because it's because the title is I think ambiguous, and certainly the way the film begins, it's great, because you have to participate, and that's something that's missing from a lot of movies today that make the terrible, well, film has always had the terrible side effect that it does it all for you. The music swells at certain times, it tells you when to laugh, tells you when to cry, crosses the T's and dot the I's, you know who the hero is, the bad guy is, right? It's pretty much laid out for you. So that's why
I resist that heavily in I don't care for, like you said, to have it spelled out and everything told to me. I don't care for that. I want it to come at me in a different way when I see something, and so that's my tendency, is to want to make something that way as well. One of the things that I find is that one of our intentions, our aesthetic intentions in our company, is that we operate on simultaneous levels, and so there's usually a conscious and a subconscious layer that are both happening at the same time, and then you either have to yield to that, or but usually you can't quite get everything intellectually first go around, you know, and so you just kind of have to let it wash over you, and then we often get comments that people had dreams about it after the fact. And it really is something in that not wanting to spell it out to engage you in a way where you're bringing yourself to the piece, you know,
And you know, the participatory nature of it is something I enjoy, because there's very, like I said, very few films today where you feel like you're engaged in moments. I mean, I still believe that the cinema, like life, is about, you remember the moments, Like, you know, there's very few people you go and you say, "What, you know, that film that you love, tell me about it," and they will more often than not tell you about the moments they enjoyed, right? They might start off talking about the plot, but then they'll say, "Oh, but then I liked the bit where this happened, or I liked the bit where that happened, or I like where he said this or she said that." It's very seldom that, you know, you watch a movie and you are participating and you hear a response like, "What did you think of that movie?" You say, "Well, I was immersed. It is immersive."
Were you surprised by that? Like you said, the title, you weren't sure.
I was very surprised. Like, as the film began, and I was sort of like, okay, it's definitely not a post-apocalyptic comedy.
right.
You know, it's not The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. But it was a good surprise in a way. It was a good sort of sleight of hand, I felt, because the title doesn't prepare you for what you're about to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many titles of films, and I think sometimes because film, you know, the mainstream film is primarily centered around, like, the marketing is a huge part of cinema today.
Right.
And they spend hundreds of millions of dollars now on marketing alone. It's been well documented throughout history that titles of films have been changed by the marketing department, because they think that a certain title will play better in certain, will test better in certain arenas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going on for ages. So,
right.
But when the title is, or the campaign is ambiguous, I think that I might be the silent minority, but certainly not the vocal majority, but I think that it makes you... There's a magnetic quality then to the piece, because once you discover it's not what your preconceived notion may be, it is a magnetic, because then now, instead of having, you know, it's very, very rare today that you are unaware of a film's parts, the sum of its parts, because you see the sum of its parts all over the internet, right? You see a teaser trailer, then an official trailer, then the second trailer, then the TV spots, the posters,
right,
the character posters. You know, so by the time you sit down and watch the film, you're essentially just getting the bits that you haven't seen already. And so there's no room for myth or misconception, because you are sold exactly what they want to sell you. You're told exactly what they want to tell you. And so then you pick up on the rest of it, and it either it all fits together nicely and you're happy and you've got your $15 worth, or you're disappointed because it doesn't live up to the hype.
Yeah.
But the beauty of Anson Buell and other films of its kind is that for some people the title might completely make sense. For me, it was slightly like, oh, I didn't know what to expect, but I like that. And I like... I like the then... having been sort of, having in the opening scenes being shed of that, what I think it might have been or might be, being then magnetically drawn and sort of say, okay, now, for the first time in a long time, I'm now at the mercy of the storyteller where he's going to take me, because I'm not sure where he's going to take me. And that's a gift you don't get very often.
Cool. Yeah, I appreciate that. The comment, it is interesting because it's risky to, in that sense that we never knew how people were going to find the film. Because if you're not spoon-feeding it to them,
yes,
they have to take the risk and then make the discovery.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's been a challenge for us. And so I appreciate someone like you, you know, providing a potential for others to discover the film. I appreciate it a lot.
And so how, I mean, as far as distribution, are you like, has it played at all theatrically or?
Not at all theatrically. It's available streaming. Amazon is streaming it and Vimeo.
Right.
And we have a distributor who's kind of working on worldwide, but it was able to be discovered once they put it on streaming. They've been trying to sell it internationally. Not for theatrical distribution, though. We kind of did festivals and then kind of skipped into that distribution.
Right, yeah.
Uh, yeah, so that's really the access point at this point. We're hoping to get it out on DVD so people can kind of open it. I don't know that that, you know, is the dying form, but we have been getting word that people that like the genre like to own it.
Yeah.
They want to have it in their hand.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, I know that they've talked about DVDs and that type of media being on the way out. I think I'm with that crowd. I think you still, if you love a movie, you still want it. You want something tangible. It's like a book sometimes, yeah. Even though you can download any book to an e-reader or something. There's still a wonderful thing about I still buy the books. I want to have the book in my hand. I like to turn pages. You don't have to charge a book. You know, and I mean, it's not, you know,
the book will survive the apocalypse.
Yeah, sure, yeah, and I mean that's the great thing. I don't know if you're aware of it, but Nicholas Meyer in the commentary for The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II, talking about when they discover Khan's, what they find out is the Botany Bay, the felled ship of Khan, and there are books on the shelf. There's Moby Dick, and he makes a comment. He says, "Yes, there are books on the shelf." He said, "I believe that there are books. There'll be books in the 23rd century, in the 25th century, because for all of the ages that printed." Whether it be stories or whatever, novels, whatever you want to say, there will always, I think, be that. I don't think it will ever go away. I hope it never does. Because the passing on of stories of history in the form of a book, you know, it's more than just, you know, I'm a snob, I prefer books instead of an e-reader sort of thing. It's more about the handing down, like how many of us grew up, you know, our father said, "Oh, you should read this book. You know, I read it when I was a kid. It was, you know, my favorite story." Right. And then he passes it on to son, who passes it on to son, who passes it on. You know, and how many? I mean, I don't know about you, but I've encountered a lot of great authors, obscure authors in many different genres, in secondhand bookstores, and they might have only written a handful of books back in the 50s or the 70s or whenever.
Right.
And been one of thousands of people published, you know, in paperback or whatever, and been resigned to the remainder tables. But, you know, they're dusty cathedrals with all this wonderful material. So yeah, I don't think it's completely done, because personally, if it's a film I like, if it's a book I like, I want the book. I want the, you know.
Right.
I miss VHS.
I agree, and I feel that they will last. And like you said, maybe it's not in one person's library, but it's in another person's library. And I don't want the only library to exist to be on the cloud somewhere.
Yeah, because if something goes wrong or something goes down, I mean, we put an awful lot of faith in technology, you know, the fact that the power will never go out.
Right.
Because the second it does, I mean, think about the chaos.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
But it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you this afternoon where you are, Barry. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. I'm certainly going to shout from the rooftops to go and see the further adventures of Anson Buell in No Man's Land. It is a wonderful, albeit iconic, meditation, but also beautiful, poetic, wonderful movie. I really enjoyed it, and I have really enjoyed sitting down with you this afternoon.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
It's really great, and I hope that I hope it does eventually come out, you know, in some form that the people who love it can purchase it, and like we were just talking about, and pass it on to their friends and say, "Hey, have you seen this?" You know, I mean, you know, that's another way that, you know, movies used to get around, you know, back in the the dark ages of VHS.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how many times did your friend say, "Oh, you know, I just got this new tape. You need to check this one out. This is, you know, a great movie." Because,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of films that were, you know, the streaming and all that is a good thing, because it is a platform for independent filmmakers to get their work out there to a large audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the streaming, if you're in a place where there's no streaming facilities, you're kind of out on a limb, you know. Not that there's too many places like that, but there are people that obviously don't have that facility. So having a copy, or certainly having the ability to loan someone, if you can get a copy and say, "Oh, have you seen this?" I think it's still a way that films survive. And I mean, talking about VHS, how many films? Right. How many films that came out theatrically, that did have a theatrical release, are still with us today and now have cult followings because they found a second life on VHS? So I really hope for Anson Buell's sake that it does find its way to some sort of tactile media, so that it can be passed around and more word of mouth can be generated, because that's sometimes the best marketing. Other than spending $300 million on a poster and print campaign and bus sides and all that sort of stuff, I still think the best word of mouth is people watching a good movie and going and telling their friends, hey, you need to see this. And certainly that is my mission right here on Podcasting Softly to do so, and I'm happy to have come across it. And I look forward to future Barry Hunt films. Unfortunately, I don't live locally, so you know, if you have something playing at your theatre, unfortunately, I won't be able to pop round, because I don't live around the block, unfortunately.
Right.
but I look forward to future endeavours, and please do let us know if you make another film or something. We would love to hear about it and talk about it.
Definitely. Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
All right, mate.